within our ability and our physical structuring here. I just don't see how it comes up with a factor. Like, if you, well, of course, a smoky room isn't going to affect it versus a non-smoky room. But what I'm seeing here is that we can't just determine a factor based on what you would just... I don't get it, Dick. I don't get it. The mass of the object is not assumed.
Casey, your choice. Okay, we've got Paul and then Wes in that order. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead with your comment.
I need a basic math question answered. I'm going to go with the ball and the bat. So common pitcher could throw a ball nowadays at 90 miles an hour. Let's say the batter swings the bat, and the bat, when it contacts the ball, the bat is going at 50 miles an hour. You said you're doubling the speed of the bat, so you're making that 100 miles an hour, and you're taking the speed of the ball that the pitcher threw it at 90, so that means that's coming back at the pitcher if he's going to get hit at 190 miles an hour. If you had a radar gun, is that what you would register? Back to you, Dick.
If that baseball was perfect as far as its coefficient of restitution, in other words, its bounce capability, you bounce a baseball off the ground, there's a whole lot of funny things going on inside that ball, and it's less than perfect. It doesn't bounce all the way back up to your altitude. But if it could, in theory, you could make a ball with very high bounce efficiency. And then the answer would be yes. It would be coming back at the pitcher at 190 miles an hour. That ball, when it's been batted by a really healthy batter, can come back at that pitcher at a rate at which can do damage if it hits him. It could also, if you calculate how many miles per hour the ball must be moving from the batter's box in order to be at a high enough altitude to go over the outfield wall, you calculate what that speed is. You'll find out you have to be adding the speed of the bat twice to the ball in order to reach those kind of speeds. If you didn't have that speed, you'd never be able to hit the ball out of the park. I know you need some further information on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
No, I think that's great, but I'm not sure really why you're doubling the speed of the bat, but I'll go with that. Sounds good. I'd love to put a radar gun on the, I'm sure they've done that, but on the ball coming back after the guy hits it. Back to you. Very good information, Dick. WS2.
Well, whether we're talking about a baseball bat or a ping pong paddle, in my example where the paddle is moving 2 meters per second and the ball is moving 3 meters per second, and it's a perfect ball, and let's assume I'm doing it in a vacuum so we don't have air resistance. That's giving George a lot of trouble. So I'm doing this in a vacuum. I'm doing it on the moon, so to speak. The closing velocity of a 3-meter ball and a 2-meter bat, the closing velocity is 5. So the closing velocity between ball and bat is 5. The ball, a perfect ball, bounces off that paddle. It leaves the paddle at 5. But the paddle is moving 2. You have to move, you have to add the 2 of the paddle to the ball, and it comes out at a total of 7. The bottom line of all that is you take the speed of the paddle, double it, and add it to the ball. The speed of the first effect of the paddle is it increases the closing velocity between paddle and ball. After the strike, the ball is leaving the paddle at that closing velocity compared to the paddle. But the paddle is moving 2, and you have to add another 2, and it makes a total of 7. So you see how you end up doubling the speed of the paddle or doubling the speed of the bat in that situation, assuming the bat or the paddle is very heavy compared to the ball. If they were equal in weight, another complicating factor takes place. But assuming the bat is very heavy compared to the ball, and in both cases we're assuming the ball has a perfect bounce characteristic, both of these are ideal. And particularly in the case of a baseball, that bounce characteristic is quite a bit lower in efficiency than a good ping pong ball. So there's starting to make a little bit more sense, though, the phenomena of what we're discussing here, the, what I'm calling the ping-pong paddle effect. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Very good. I'm fascinated with the practicality of it. You know, if both situations are similar, you know, your ping-pong or your baseball, I'm more fascinated with the baseball because ping-pong ball, yeah, it's going to come back at you fast enough to maybe knock your eye out, but a baseball will take your freaking head off. That's very good information. Back to you, Dick.
Now, part of the reason why I was using a perfect ping-pong ball and a very heavy paddle, a ball with a perfect bounce characteristic. In reality, you can't buy a ball that good. But when it comes to air molecules, they are that good. Every air molecule bouncing off that plunger, or every molecule of air bouncing off another air molecule, every one of those bounces is perfect because they never really touch each other. They just come very close until the negative charge of the electron cloud around each object creates electrostatic repulsion so that they never touch. You can heat up some air and put it into a perfect calorimeter, something that's got very good insulation, and measure the temperature today. And if the insulation is good enough, you come back tomorrow, you'll measure the exact same temperature. Each of those air molecules are bouncing across each other, bouncing against each other billions of times per second. If they were losing energy on every one of those bounces, they would have nowhere near the same velocity tomorrow, and your thermometer measures velocity, measures a speed, and you would measure a lower temperature. If the insulation is good enough, you'll measure the exact same temperature tomorrow as you did today. All of those billions of bounces lose no energy. That's a hard one to believe, but it looks like that's what's taking place. Wes had a comment on all of the above. WX2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
I believe question about density was valid. It is kind of confusing question that you ask. We could form it a little bit different way. Say we have a ball at given mass that is moving at given direction with given speed. And let's say that ball collides head on with another ball at rest. So if the collision is perfectly elastic, what would be the speed of direction of each ball after the collision? So missing parameter in here is mass of the second ball or the mass of the paddle. Also, we know that for elastic collision, head-on collision, the relative velocity of approach equals relative velocity of separation. And you didn't talk about it. And to exchange.
Yeah, if two ping-pong balls hit each other, where one was sitting still and the other one is moving, you've now got a more complicated situation where you have to have conservation of momentum and conservation of energy, assuming they're perfect bouncing balls. And so now you're going to get a more complicated situation than the one that I described. But the one that I described, if you assume the paddle is very heavy compared to the ball, and the paddle is not being deflected, and there's no wind resistance because I'm doing it in a vacuum, and I've got a very high efficiency ball, then the numbers I came up with, the 3 plus 2, 5, and 7 numbers, and the individual velocities and final velocity of the ball, meaning moving 7, that's very close to what you'll see if you did the experiment with a good ball in a vacuum. And so a really good ball in a vacuum is, so to speak, what you have with air molecules, because each air molecule doesn't really strike the paddle. It comes very close and bounces off of it by electrostatic repulsion. And all those air molecules are bouncing across, bouncing away from each other by electrostatic repulsion. So at the molecular level, air molecules, you could say, are extremely efficient. And do we worry about the density of the air molecules when they're hitting each other? Should we be considering the density? Do RIW listening?
Because then we could think about density of an object, approximation as your approximation of the paddle weight. And not only weight, but density. You didn't say what paddle was made of, wood or metal. So density is the important factor in here, and to exchange.
Are you telling me if I had a very heavy paddle made out of wood, and if I have a very heavy paddle made out of metal, and a very light ping pong ball, are you saying I'm going to get a drastic difference in the response? Is that what you're saying, Wes?
Absolutely. Because you didn't mention the force of each object. Density of each object is a different material made, that each paddle was made is different, and then force needed to give a given impact to the ball by that factor, bouncing ball, which would be factor of separation, is going to be different. Don't you think so?
If I've made my paddle out of a hard wood, and I'm using an ordinary ping pong ball, are you telling me I'm going to get a great big deflection of that hard wood of the paddle at the instant of impact? Are you telling me that the wood is going to be deflected by a significant amount? Is that what you're trying to say?
I would ask Dr. Roy for help. Again, we know that for an elastic head-on collision, the relative velocity of approach equals relative velocity of separation. You didn't mention separation. Dr. Roy.
AC2GS, K2RW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay. People are complicating it and simplifying it and doing all kinds of interesting things. Ultimately, it's the difference between a so-called elastic collision and inelastic collision. If you have a perfectly hard object that bangs against another perfectly hard object, none of the energy is absorbed in compression and deflection and such, and so kinetic energy is conserved, and momentum is conserved in the system. So it's not particularly the density, except how it relates to the mass, because the mass gives you the momentum, and the momentum has to be conserved, and so the amount of momentum that you impart upon the ball determines the velocity of the ball. Now, you get deeply confused by air resistance due to pressure on air and such, but I think that's an unnecessary complication. So I think it's more to do with mass and nothing really much to do with density, because it's really momentum. It's the conservation of kinetic energy. And as far as gas being a perfect elastic structure, it pretty much is, although the collisions with the electron clouds do produce photons. They just get reabsorbed, and that's the radiation aspect of thermal conductivity. You have conduction, convection, and radiation, and the radiation is the electrons pounding on each other.
I would agree with that, only if we say the density of the wood is exactly the same one as density of the metal, and the angle of approach is 90 degrees. Dr. Roy.
Thank you, Wes.
I disagree that the density is a factor, unless, of course, it changes the total mass. Then it certainly has a difference. But mass for mass should be approximately the same. I don't really see how density plays into it, unless you want to futz around and say that the density causes the structure to be more rubbery and compressible and less elastic a collision.
So you gave the answer at the end of your sentence. Wood has different structure. If we make wood as metal, if we give that wood exactly the same weight and the density of the metal, we would have no difference. But how much of the wood you need to have exactly the same weight as the metal one. And then you're giving the same force. So you're not mentioning it. You're giving the same force to both of the of those puddles. Don't you see the difference is gonna be? That let me drop. That wooden puddle is going to be humongous comparing to the metal one. And then you're not increasing the force of your swing and direction.
Wes, if you and I are playing ping pong and you're using a metal paddle and I'm using a wooden paddle, are you telling me you're going to win every time?
It depends on the technique that you use. That's a joke. I don't know. Intuition.
Assume you and I have equal skill. You're using a metal paddle and I'm using a wooden paddle. Does that mean you're going to win all the time if we have equal skill?
No, it doesn't mean. Because you didn't mention angle of the approach. Playing ping pong is from different angles and using different techniques. Even though that we can compare the paddles. So I see question as irrelevant and to exigent.
B2FIU.
Yeah, the main thing I'm trying to stress with all of this is that you ask the average person, what does the thermometer measure? And quite often they'll give you the answer, hot and cold. Let me drop. And if you ask them what is hot or cold, you can eventually get them to say, well, it's heat, more or less of it. But what is heat? Not very many people really know that at the molecular level, heat is the average speed of the air molecules. If you're standardizing the temperature and pressure, then the hotter air has the air molecules moving faster. The air in the room with you is moving 500 meters per second, an amazing number to me, 1.5 times the speed of sound. That's the average speed. Some of them are faster, some of them are slower at each instant of time, but that's their average. And the air molecules in the bottom of that pump could be moving at 1,000 meters per second. On that toy where you put a piece of paper inside and hit the plunger real fast, and the piece of paper instantaneously turns on fire, you're seeing a lot of temperature there in a hurry. A lot of high-speed air molecules are in the bottom of that toy after you've hit the plunger, so to speak. So not many people realize the thermometer is measuring speed of the molecules of the thing that you're measuring the temperature of. In the case of a solid, it's how fast the molecules are vibrating in space. But in the case of a gas, it's how fast they're moving.
Let me ask.
I think it's time we.
What he thinks about it. We have two paddles. One is wooden paddle of the same weight and mass as the metal one. And then we have the same swing that we apply to both of them. Would that be different, or would that be not different because of the size of wooden...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
About it.
I think it would be very difficult to see the difference of using a metal paddle versus a wooden paddle. And by the way, ping pong paddles almost always have a rubber covering over it, so that you got a coefficient of friction so that you can able to put some spin on the ball, able to put some English on it, so to speak. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Perhaps for the people having problem with this density issue, rather than a different material entirely with a different type of elasticity, try and stay in the metal kingdom. You have a paddle that's made out of aluminum. You have a paddle that's made out of steel. The density is different. Do you change them so that they have the same exact mass? Do you guys think that the guy with the lighter density or the heavier density makes any difference at all?
I'm talking about if you want to reach the same mass. If you want to reach the same mass of aluminum one versus the metal one, iron one, that paddle must be bigger. And then you apply the same force. Would that be any difference to the ball that you hit? Dr. Roy.
You said bigger, and I think you mean thicker. The aluminum paddle, if I make it thicker than the steel paddle, but I make both of them the same weight, I think they're going to behave in a very similar manner. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
I would agree, Dick. I think it's almost identical. I mean, the devil is in the details. If you change the dimension, you change the air resistance factors, and that's going to have an effect in the real world. But this is hopefully a thought experiment, and in a thought experiment, the momentum is going to be the same. The density of the material by itself shouldn't determine anything.
I agree with that. The only thing is that if we think about adding material aluminium to reach the same mass, but not increase diameter, but increase only thickness, the result might be similar. But nobody said how we're going to increase that mass. Dr. Roy.
Hold on now. It's George that feels that the real difference is density of the materials. So, George, if we now have a steel paddle and an aluminum paddle, and I've made the aluminum paddle thicker, so it has the exact same mass as the steel paddle, but now I have significant differences in the density of the materials, are you telling me one paddle is going to bounce that ball very different than the other paddle? KD2FIU, K2LIW, go ahead, George. We didn't get back to George soon enough. Go ahead, Roy.
Exactly with what? Are we done with the subject, or are we going to talk about it some more? I'm a little confused.
I think we've gone far enough with this one tonight, and it's time for a nice science and physics report, which is going to be science and physics report number 27. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, this is AC2GS, and I want to keep everyone in mind that there is a mailbag. If you're so interested in contacting me with any subjects or topics or what have you, it is mailbag@ac2gs.com, which is my call sign, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. So just mailbag@ac2gs.com, and you can give me any of the information or topics that you want to discuss. Let me drop. By the way, out of sheer curiosity, am I dropping for a half a second every 30 seconds still, or has that stopped happening?
I think the frequency of it happening is a little bit lower, but it is still happening once in a while. Roy, go ahead.
Oh, well, que sera, sera. Getting back to last week's episode where I discussed the intriguing experiments about polywater, I actually found the original Popular Science article that I read back in 1973, and I put it up on the links on my page. I have a page that if you type in roy.ac2gs.com, it has all the little links that I'm talking about. And this particular one you can get at called polywater.ac2gs.com. We'll give you a reprint of the Popular Science article, and you too could make your own polywater. Also, I wanted to discuss the micro boiling point determination, because for the hell of it, I did not recall how I did it back in 45 years ago. Let me drop. The trick is what you do with the capillary. An open capillary is basically a hollow straw-like figure, but it's very, very thin and very small. And if you just stick a hollow rod into a test tube with a few drops of water, you don't really get much of anything happening. But if you seal up one end of the capillary tube and you turn it into kind of like a micro-small test tube, and then you turn it upside down so that the sealed part is up, and the open part is down at the sample test tube that you put a few drops of liquid into. As you heat the liquid, at one point, the vapor pressure of the liquid you're testing will equal the atmospheric pressure. And when that happens, the air trapped in the capillary tube will be forced out in favor of the vaporized fluid that you want to know what its boiling point is. Then, when you drop the temperature down at a certain point, the bubbles will stop coming out of the capillary tube. That's the exact melting point of that liquid. And it works for something like 0.2 cubic centimeters of fluid. So a few drops of fluid, you can find your boiling points. So that's how micro boiling point works. As long as we're doing chemistry, I might as well kind of ask you guys what you think of sublimation. Everyone kind of recalls being taught sublimation in their chemistry classes in high school. Usually they show iodine that turns into a gas. They show carbon dioxide that goes from a solid to a gas. Sometimes they even show mothballs that evaporate from solid to gas. So my question for the audience is that the only thing that iodine can do? It can do solids and it can do gas. Do you think you can melt iodine into a liquid?
A VDH would comment?
Yes, VDH.
I think under higher pressure, it would turn to a liquid. Go ahead.
Excellent point, VDH. Does anyone else have any opinion? Okay, VDH had a great idea in that there's something called a phase diagram. You could Wikipedia it, you could Google it, you could do all kinds of things with it. That gives you the temperature and pressure and the different phases that exist at those points. But surprisingly, most people, at least I think that iodine goes directly from a solid to a gas and nothing in between at room atmosphere, one atmosphere. In point of fact, if you actually take some iodine and heat it up to 236 degrees Fahrenheit, or 113.7 centigrade, if you're into centigrade, it melts into a liquid, and then it boils. So iodine actually exists in one atmosphere of pressure as a liquid.
Yes,
Wes.
Actually, when you take liquid nitrogen, LN2, and you go to -196.97, I believe, then it's turning into the liquid. Then it's turning into a solid when you go lower. But then, from that, it's not going to liquid, it's going to gas. That's why it's exploding into action.
Sublimation is actually more accurately described as the transition that solids have into gases, which lends itself to an interesting question. Do some substances sublimate, or do most substances sublimate?
You got me here. Some substances sublimate.
Okay, what we have here possibly is a problem with semantics. Let me give you a question. You take an ice cube. You put an ice cube in your freezer by itself, and you leave it there nice and cold. You open it up, and you close the refrigerator repeatedly to change the air a little bit, but not enough to melt anything. What happens to the ice cube?
It's going to vaporize, and you're going to see a vapor out of it.
Yeah, so basically, ice cubes sublimate, right?
Correct.
Well, the point of the exercise is that ultimately just about everything sublimates to a degree. Sometimes it's incredibly obvious, like iodine. Sometimes it's slightly obvious, like an ice cube. Sometimes it's ridiculously not obvious, like a block of platinum, which is going to take a real long time to sublimate. But the bottom line is that there is an equilibrium in the solid surface where a few of the atoms can pinch off and attain enough energy to become gaseous, and sublimation is pretty much a universal concept. Now, some of the things that we think that sublimate, like carbon dioxide is a perfect example that VDH talked about. Carbon dioxide exists only as a gas or a solid at one atmosphere. You can't get it to turn into a liquid. But if you raise the pressure enough at certain temperatures, you can get liquids. And so that's what phase diagrams are all about. They show the transitions from solid to liquid to gas. what pressures, what temperatures, and you'll see all kinds of interesting things if you take a look at the phase diagram. So when you have nothing better to do someday, take a look at a phase diagram.
That is interesting. I never asked myself a question, how many substances go to the triple point? Is it more of them or is it less of them? We take any possible substances. But interesting is what happened to the water when you lower the pressure. So you put a vacuum pump. And to actually...
Okay, yeah, as you lower the pressure, it boils at a lower and lower temperature, which is a pain in the backside for some people who live in high elevation. You know, they're trying to boil an egg or do other things that require a temperature of 100 degrees centigrade, and unfortunately up in the mountains, water doesn't boil at 100 degrees centigrade. So, yeah, pressure has a definitive effect. And does everything have a triple point? Well, on a theoretical basis, probably yes. In a practical basis, there are some molecules that are unstable at the triple point and would degrade. So in practice, there are probably a bunch of compounds that are just not stable enough to have a triple point. But ultimately, thermodynamically, on a theoretical basis, yeah, most things should have a triple point.
Absolutely right. It corresponds to the lower pressure of which the substance can exist as a liquid. So the reverse process of sublimation is the position. And to extreme.
Copy, S2N. And K2RW.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, Roy, I spent a couple of years in Denver. And Denver is the Mile High City. So what happened was they had it was a common thing that you cook the eggs, 3-minute eggs were always cooked for 4 minutes. Because of that exact reason, living high up in altitude. Back to you, Roy.
There's all kinds of surprising problems. I understood that plasma television sets didn't work very well in Denver because the plasma gas, I guess, would leak out because of a slightly lower pressure or something. There was a lot of complaints. So, Dick, you had something you wanted to add.
That ice cube is sitting all by itself in the freezer and very slowly subliming and slowly shrinking. If your freezer was working at a vacuum, would the ice cube sublime a little bit faster? I think the answer might be yes.
Yes, I would agree. What you have is an equalization, equilibrium question. So at a lower pressure, the equilibrium would be shifted towards the gaseous phase.
Now, when it comes to crazy subliming, the silver amalgam fillings that they used to put into people's mouths, nowadays they use all kinds of fancy composites, but the silver amalgam fillings are such that with very sensitive instrumentation, they used to be able to measure the mercury vapor gas that was in your mouth. I think we're only talking about parts per billion. But still, there's a very slow subliming-like phenomena taking place with silver amalgam fillings in a person's mouth. It appears to be. I think that's why they're able to measure the mercury vapor gas. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW. I wonder if you ever heard about that.
Yes, those were the great days. I don't know. I never really thought of them as silver amalgam. I always thought of them as mercury amalgam. And nowadays, people who kind of think too much about having mercury in their mouths are very, very upset. But thankfully, it's inorganic. It's the organic mercury that's deeply problematic. And supposedly it drove Isaac Newton crazy. He was an alchemist in his part-time gig. He was playing around trying to make base metals into gold, and one of the things that he used with was mercury. And too much contact with mercury, as was known in the hatters, people who made felt hats, drove them crazy. So mercury is not good for your central nervous system, but fortunately, as a inorganic compound, it's not terribly dangerous. And well, a lot of us old-timers have mercury amalgams stuck in our teeth.
So you're telling me that there's both a organic and an inorganic form of mercury. If I take mercury and I make a mercury amalgam filler, does that make the mercury inorganic? Over to you, Roy.
Well, organic means that it's combined with carbon, that it's locked in an organic molecule, a protein, an amino acid, what have you. In the amalgam, it's kind of locked together for the most part with the silver and other metals, and so it doesn't really interact with anything, and there's nothing biological on it that's going to shift it over. The problem is, in the ocean, a lot of interesting things go on with mercury and bacteria and such, and they combine it into organic chemicals, then it gets ingested by bigger and bigger fish, and there's no real good biological way to clear mercury organic compounds. We're not really designed for that. So it just collects endlessly, and eventually, if you get it at high enough concentration, it tends to collect in the central nervous system, unfortunately. But non-organic, inorganic, means that it simply has no carbon atoms on it. So living organisms don't really know quite what to do with inorganic compounds. It takes plants and bacteria to turn inorganic things into organic things. Okay, I guess we've done chemistry. Let's do a little bit of biology. Biology is always fun. In a little segment that I'd like to try and call, why don't we get a user's manual with this thing? Which points out somewhat bizarre aspects of humanity that people don't really think about, aren't aware about, and sometimes refute. So let me just break, and I'll come back and tell you this one. Okay, Doug, so this is about vision. The human vision is very curious. We cut a lot of corners. We do a lot of strange things to get the transmissions rate down and the noise levels down and having to deal with the retina, which is interestingly designed. There's a very small area that's very, very sensitive and capable of fine detail, but most of it isn't. And we don't really know that because we kid ourselves. So my first question about this is, if you put your face close to the mirror, and if you have a mirror, feel free to do it, and stare at your eyes. Now, you can focus either on your right eye or your left eye. So as you're looking at your eyes and focusing on, say, the right eye, then change your focus to your left, then change your focus to the right, back and forth, and tell me if you see anything unusual when you do that. Okay, I'll give people a chance to go over to their mirror and test that little question out, and I'll just start to say that there's a few major movements that go on with eye movement that we kind of take for granted. We just kind of look at things and we see them. There's something called vergent movement, which is the mechanism that our brain uses to merge the two images from our right eye and our left eye so that we don't have cross eyes, we don't have double vision, and we're able to do 3D kind of approximations for triangulating things. So, again, people take that for granted. When I was a little kid, I had a lazy eye, so I was able to actually turn one eye off and turn the other one on and just jump from one eye to the other, and sometimes I can cross them and wall-eye them and do all kinds of fun stuff. But it's usually hardwired in us to have vergent eye movement. So that's vergence. There's another movement called smooth pursuit. Let me drop. Anyway, there's another one called smooth pursuit. Now, if you just take a finger and put it in front of your face and move the finger, you move your eye perfectly tracking that finger. It's a nice, smooth movement. Now, the trouble is that if you tried to move your eye in the same sort of way without that moving object in front of you, you would find it somewhere between difficult to impossible, because we're not wired to do a smooth pursuit without something to pursue. Again, that's part of our wiring. So if any of you guys have nothing better to do, try and move your eyes smoothly without a target for it. Yes, Wesley.
You talk about the flickering image. So do you think that repeatedly doing that would train the brain to acknowledge the eye looking back at itself and train it to go also straight?
Well, Wesley, have you tried the little experiment?
I did it when I was a child. It delivers a sort of flickering image. So if you look straight ahead, then let's say left eye, and then you try to look at right eye. My right eye turned to the left eye, and there was some kind of flickering view, I believe, when I tried to look straight on and to exit.
Well, let's hear if anyone actually went to the mirror and tried this little experiment tonight. It's a very simple one. It can be done in seconds, and the results are kind of fascinating to me. VDH? Yes, VDH.
It seems to be analogous to the like the step response and the ramp response of a control system. I notice a little overshoot when I try it. Go ahead.
Okay, but has anyone else tried it, and does it seem to make sense for them, or are they a little bit... is my question. Okay, so we'll just discuss it. As opposed to what I just mentioned, the smooth pursuit eye movements that are nice and smooth, the ones where you shift your gaze from one place to another place are called saccadic motions. That's sudden, sharp motions. And you can't really adjust the rate. You just kind of program your eye to move from point A to point B, and it does it as quick as it humanly can. And you can't kind of do half a saccade, you can't do three-quarters of a saccade, it's all or none type of thing. And curious aspects to these saccadic movements. Normally you would think that when you shifted your vision from one focus to another focus, you would get a blur artifact. Most people, if they're looking in the mirror and they move their eyes and focus to the right and left, you don't really see much of a moving artifact. You don't really see much of an eyeball-changing artifact. So what the eye and the brain is actually doing is called saccadic masking. It actually masks the blur and masks the transition from looking at your right eye to your left eye. Let me drop.
Y2H.
Yes, Lou.
Are you going to talk about chronostasis or the stopped clock illusion?
Absolutely, Lou. You win the gold star for the night. Yes, not only does our brain block the blur to not annoy us, apparently, but it is so subtle and so mysterious that it blocks the fact that it's blocking that blur. It freezes and holds on to the first image until you stabilize on the second place. So even though your eye ain't looking at anything, you see the first image, then you see the second image, and you don't see any artifact in between. So what you see isn't necessarily what your eyeball saw. So I tend to find that that's rather fascinating. It's called saccadic suppression, and it's just one of the many indications that your body does all kinds of things that you have no clue that it's doing. Now, I have one last eyeball trick for you guys. Very common. You're looking at something. You move your head in some direction or other, and you don't lose the sight of what you're focusing on. Your eyes track the image as you move your head all over the place. People kind of take that for granted. They don't really think of it. Is it voluntary, involuntary? I think most people would say that it's both, that it's primarily voluntary, but it's so second nature that you don't even think about it. So how many people think that, and it's called vestibulo-ocular eye movement, how many people think that it's completely voluntary? How many people think it's involuntary?
I think it's involuntary.
Okay, VDH, does anyone else think it's involuntary or voluntary or something even different than that? For people out there who have nothing better to do, little experiment, very simple, doesn't even require a mirror. Just close your eyes and gently put your fingers on top of your eyelid so that you can feel the eye underneath. And then swivel your head to and fro and see what you feel.
It's moving.
Yes, Wesley, your eye is moving because all of our eyes move because it's hardwired into us. We have to actually... It's very difficult to physically try and force your eyeball not to track that way. It will do it, no matter what you pretty much do, it'll do it. It's automatic, and it has two connections that trigger it. One is your inner ear, your vestibular apparatus, which gives you your sense of position in three dimensions. There's little calcium deposits that go in semicircular canals and that go down to the lowest point in the gravity and send signals back to your brain. But amazingly, in addition, there are proprioceptive position sensors in your neck muscles to kind of give it a fine tuning. So those two things together will cause your eyeball to involuntarily track unless you forcibly move it to a different focus. So just another thing that we sort of take for granted, it is completely involuntary, and it's very difficult to oppose, just like a lot of things that we think are things that we decided to do, and it's just our body doing it for itself, and we're making up excuses after the fact. So I hate to get psychological with you guys, but human beings are very curious creatures.
Y2H.
Yes, Lou.
So that works unless you're a chicken. Apparently, if you take a chicken and move it around, you'll see his head will, like, bob. That's because their eyes don't move. They have to actually move their head.
Yes, extraocular muscles of this type don't apply to any bird, to my knowledge. All the birds are wired in that very interesting way. They're basically hardwired. Their vestibular apparatus is wired into their neck muscles and the motor controls of the brain. And so it's kind of cute. Just recently I saw a picture of that, of some poor bobbing bird.
Yeah. Let me say a little bit about the that clock illusion, stop clock illusion, if I may.
Certainly, Lou. Be my guest.
Some of you may have recalled experiencing this, maybe not, but if you have a clock with a second hand on it, and, continuously smooth rotation, not 1 second at a time, although it would work on 1 second at a time also, and you look at it, and it seems like the second hand is almost frozen for like a half a second or maybe a second and a half or 2 seconds before it starts moving. And it's similar to what Roy was talking about before, but the kicker is that when you transit your eyes onto the clock, and that whole transit period is typically noise, and he talked about how your brain masks that out, what's happening here is it's taking the image that you just looked at, the clock, the secondhand clock, as soon as you lay your eyes on it, and it's backfilling that image into your memory, which is really weird. So it's kind of going back in time and laying a false memory track for that short period of time. Roy?
Yes, indeed, Lou. That's a very good way of describing it. It's curious. Our own bodies trick ourselves. Pretty much everyone knows that there's a fovea in your retina. It's the place that has the highest resolution of images. And the problem is most of the retina doesn't. What people don't kind of understand is that we use these saccadic eye movements all the time. We jitter back and forth across a certain field where we want a better idea of what's going on. And again, we don't see the motion. We don't see the artifact. And unless someone takes a movie of us looking at a screen, we don't see our eyes, you know, blinking up and down and sideways and all over the place. So we're doing these saccadic movements all the time, and we're all unaware of it, thankfully, because I guess it would annoy us. There must be some evolutionary reason why we were wired this particular way.
WS2S, field sobriety test, right?
Yeah, that goes along with the cause of what's called nystagmus and such, alcoholism, strokes, all kinds of fun stuff. Yeah, Paul, you wanted to say something?
I tried the one where you take a pen and move it in front of your face and you follow it. Yeah, I followed it. And then without the pen, you can't make a smooth adjustment from left to right. So that was interesting. Is that what the doctors are checking for? When sometimes they'll hold the pen in front of you, you know, you go for a checkup and they'll say, follow this pen or something. Is that what they're checking for, to make sure you have that capability to smoothly move your eyes from one side to the other?
Well, in a way, they're testing for if you have nystagmus, which amounts to the inability of doing the smooth pursuit visual motion, because there's other things going on with your central nervous system that's generating a lot of noise in your ocular muscles and such. But it's for something called nystagmus, but for all intents and purposes, it's associated with that. But that's a little bit more esoteric than even the nitty-gritty details. Surprisingly, the people who studied this a great deal are computer guys who are trying to get cameras that can track movements and run programs based upon your visual field where you're looking at.
Okay, fascinating. Very good. You also mentioned lazy eye in the beginning. Is that the same as what they call amblyopia?
The amblyopia is double vision. It's either wall eye or cross eyed. It's a consequence of lazy eye, because what happens is a person, when they're very, very young, you have to train your visual cortex to correlate images and fuse images and do all these things that we now take for granted. But if someone has a problem with visual acuity in one eye versus the other, sometimes he'll favor one eye, and you won't get a perfect fusion. So people with amblyopia have very common double vision. They can't merge the images. They can't control their muscles sufficiently to position them just at the right position for the depth of field. Lazy eye is kind of a version of that. I mean, I still have it. When I'm very, very tired, one of my eyes goes off to the side. So it requires a little bit of conscious control. People with amblyopia have great problems. They just can't control it. They do surgery for it. They wanted to do surgery when I was a kid, and thankfully, no one allowed them.
Oh, okay. But even so, you had that, you're still able to do all these tests that you were just talking about with no problem.
A
little bit of effort. Now, some people who've had lazy eye and they have problems with these 3D movies. Because they can't fuse the images correctly, they can't take the detail of the two images that are used in 3D movies and fuse them into a 3D image. I have no particular problem with that. So, again, as long as I have a little bit of effort in it, everything is fused, and I see perfectly in relation to 3D. I can see what's in front and the back and such. But it depends. I mean, with my wiring, it became a little bit voluntary, as opposed to people who are walled-eyed and cross-eyed, where the connection is severed. They have no control in the opposite direction. So I kind of amused my neurophysiologist professor in medical school. He said that he wanted to take me around to show turning eyes on and off. I mean, I have one eye that's a little bit nearsighted and one that's a little bit farsighted, and I tend to kind of use them as kind of internal bifocals.
Doctor, I have a question for you.
Yes, Wes.
What's soliton?
A solitary wave impulse that has been around in the literature since the 1800s and has manifested itself in all kinds of different calculations throughout the ages. And you were showing, I think, on your YouTube video about a guy who's trying to jam it into how quarks interact, which might be interesting, although I don't know if it really fundamentally changes anything. It's more of a descriptor at this point. But it's a solitary wave.
And you don't see the connection with quarks?
I don't know. It's one of the theories involved, but it's not necessarily, it's certainly not the only theory, and it's not a proved theory. So, and even if it is a proof theory, I don't exactly know what you quite do with it, because it's just a characteristic. It's like saying something is a perfect square, which is, I guess, interesting, but what past knowing that can you do with it? It seems highly theoretical and not really of practical value, but who knows? There's a lot of things that started theoretical that turned out to be very practical. But solitons, you could see references for solitons going back to the 1800s. They're not that that unusual, but most people don't really think of them too much.
Do you consider bubble ring as a soliton?
Yes, I do.
So now we have a field of classical physics. But then, solitons in biology or solitons in magnets. And then we enter in quantum physics. And they are calculatable. So you can have nonlinear differential equations, and you can, in field of magnetic field, you can actually calculate it. You can do the math with them. So that professor from Cambridge is seeing it as force that is holding everything together. The universe, he says. Now, if you look at the Milky Way, do you consider it soliton?
I find no indication that it's a soliton, and I think that's a great generalization of the guy at Cambridge. He was suggesting that the quark-gluon interactions approximates a soliton. That's not quite the same as everything is stuck together with solitons.
So we have a presence of solitons in quantum and in classical physics. And we see it as mass and massless particles. My question to you. Electron has dual nature. Does quark has a dual nature?
Yes. All matter has a wave nature. De Broglie kind of started the concept and continued with it. So neutrons have a wave nature, protons have a wave nature, and so their constituents have a wave nature.
We have a confirmation of Dr. David Tong from Oxford. Your understanding about things bonding all things together, which is soliton.
Again, Wesley, the only thing that I heard him propose was quarks. which is incredibly esoteric because quarks really, really bind together strongly. Gluon quarks are so strong that the energy required to rip two quarks apart will produce the creation of another pair of quarks to take their place. So you're talking real heavy-duty energy, and this is not something, you don't see free quarks in the universe. They don't really exist. They existed in the early beginning of the universe when the temperatures were very, very high.